Well, that was lucky. I finished at about the right time. Morning, everybody.
Morning.
Wow, that's actually pretty impressive for 8:30 in the morning. I actually considered not actually coming to this myself and having a little bit of a sleep in this morning. So thank you all for showing up. I really appreciate it. My name is Greg Taylor. Let's kick off here. Just the last few coming in now. So this is the session I've entitled Publishing Exchange Server. Which TLA should you choose? And let me make that clear. TLA is a three-letter acronym. You'd think everyone knows that, but honestly, they don't. They come up at the end of the session, they're like, it's great and everything, but what the hell's a TLA? A three-letter acronym. We have plenty of them in the world of Microsoft and in IT in general. We have TMG and UAG and a whole bunch of other ones that are important to us this morning. So my name is Greg Taylor, as I said. So I'm a program manager in the Exchange customer adoption team, which is part of Office 365. My role in the team is to go out and talk at events like this, as well as produce guidance, customer guidance, deal with customer escalations. I get to talk to some of our most interesting and in trouble kind of customers and try and help them out of the mess that they're in. And one of the areas that I've focused on a lot over the last few years is Client Access Server. So I've done quite a lot of sessions before about publisher or about client access server configuration and all of those pieces. And one of the other pieces, you know, one of the aspects of client access server is how you publish Exchange to the internet. And that's been something I've been interested in for probably 10 or 12 years at least. And I've been involved, you know, in all kinds of angles. I've delivered sessions like this. I've written some white papers, publishing Exchange with TMG and UAG with certificate-based auth and NTLM and all of those kind of things. And this session's kind of come about really as a result of working in this space for a long time. And honestly, my opinions have kind of changed over a few years. So let's, without further ado, let's see what we're going to cover today is, there we go. Okay, so we're going to do a little bit of history. Always good to cover a little bit of history just to understand a little bit about where we came from, why we're in the situation that we're in today. Always good to look back and learn lessons from the past. Then we'll see, then I'm going to talk a bit about the risks that we have today. What are the risks that exist when publishing Exchange to the internet, and what choices do we have to mitigate against those risks? There is a variety of TLAs, a variety of three-letter acronym choices you can make. So let's talk through what some of those are and what you might choose to do. And then ultimately try and end up with some kind of recommendation. That's the goal. We'll see how far we get. So, casting our minds back. So back in the beginning of software development, there were a bunch of hippies and intellectual type folks who wrote the software and wanted to share. This is a level 200 session, by the way, right? So it's literally hand puppets and going to be lots of arm waving. So you can... This is as deep as it will get, I promise you, all right? So, bunch of hippies, intellectuals who wrote the software. That's true. And then what happened is these bad guys came along, and they figured that it was kind of interesting that all of this data was being collated and gathered and created. And it was kind of fun, actually, to get to somebody else's data, as well as valuable, obviously, in many cases, but it was kind of fun, too. So what happened was the IT security guy was born. And look at him, isn't he a handsome-looking fella, right? Okay, the IT security guy was born, and what then happened was he decided that the way to protect all these hippies and intellectuals who were writing the software was to go and build a whole bunch of big walls and put them behind walls. And so he took the NT4 servers, he put them in the closet, he put a wall in front of the closet, he actually pulled out the network cable as well before he put it in the closet as well, and probably the power too, because obviously if you can't get to the server, then it's safe, right? But it didn't really work for everyone. You see, you had the little hippie in there saying, well, people want to get to my stuff, right? That was, it's going to be like this the whole way through, I promise you, all right? Oh, it really is. Okay? And so what he did was the IT security guy decreed that we shall build a hole. We shall make a hole in the firewall. And so that is what he did. And this is true, isn't it? Right? This is exactly what happened. Well, there are some problems with that. So let's think, what are the problems that we have with that? So one of the problems was he didn't really understand what was going through the hole in the wall. He had no idea what kind of traffic was going through the hole in the wall. And the size of the hole in the wall depended on the size and the type of the traffic that might go through. And you had no idea really what this traffic was or what it was supposed to do. Was it legitimate or was it not? And one of the other concerns that the security guy had was anonymous traffic can go through the wall. He wasn't really looking at the traffic. It was just a hole. And so any kind of junk could go through the wall, which, of course, the bad guys knew. And so they exploited this fact. And so they would send all kinds of anonymous stuff through there, which was either intended for the application or just intended for, you know, to see what would happen. Okay? And that was something that else used to happen. So what happened next? The security guy went to school, and he got himself a little diploma in IT security. And he created two firewalls, because obviously two are better than one, right? I'm going to have one at the front. I'm going to have one at the back. And that surely will be more secure, because then I have only typically use the same kind of firewall at the front and at the back. But two's better than one, as we all know. And what he also then did was he created an access control list or the doorman standing on the door of the nightclub, you know, a little list about who's allowed in and who's not, undesirables. And so that was what the IT security guy did. Next, he built himself a couple of firewalls and he decided to write himself a long list of what's allowed in and what's not. Well, there are some problems with that as well. So here are the problems with that. So the HTTP filter that actually is within Windows, and we added within ISA and feature pack 1 in ISA as well, has the ability to do filtering of verbs, HTTP verbs, and do a whole bunch of clever stuff around looking at the traffic, inspecting the traffic, and checking the response, you know, the actual parameters of which the traffic should, you know, conform to before it would allow it to pass. But honestly, did anyone ever do any of that? Handful of people, right? Literally a handful of people might have decided to do that. I did it once for a customer, and it was a security type of customer. You know how they are. Put everything in a box and tape it up and throw away the tape, right? Nobody can ever get in. And you know what? It made troubleshooting it really hard, because we put all these layers in, and then it didn't work. And then we couldn't figure out why, because it was so locked down. We had to then unpick everything in order to find the layer at which it broke and then put it all back together again. Made it really hard. And most people with stuff's really hard like this is they really don't bother doing it. The other thing that was an aspect of this was the exchange team never provided guidance on how to do it. And there are many customers out there who will only do stuff that the exchange team publish as recommended and, you know, supported practice, which is, generally speaking, absolutely the right thing to do. I'm not saying it's not. But I'm saying that, you know, if Exchange had published a guide that said, here's how to lock down, you know, HTTP really tightly on everything, then I'm sure more customers would have done it. But we didn't, and so customers didn't make the changes. And so the default stayed, really, at year 2000. And here's a really interesting fact for you, that TMG and ISA Feature Pack 1 essentially have the same filter. So the filtering that's going on in TMG at the HTTP layer is from the year 2000. And it has no real understanding of what's happened in the world of Exchange since the year 2000. Does that surprise you? It should. Fairly surprising to me. So you've got to remember that what really the tool that you're trying to use to do this protection is already considerably out of date. And the other aspect, of course, is complexity, right? We have, you know, it's kind of interesting when you talk to customers at a show like this that complexity does a couple of things. So some customers love it. They make it as hard as they can possibly make it. And the conversation we generally have is you need to simplify. Or customers really simplify too far and, you know, then they need to do additional things to configure. But there's one thing that's true for sure, which is complexity breed support cases like bunny rabbits, right? And this is true too. So the more complex you, and this noise will go on and on and on until I click this button, all right? So, come on in, take a seat. There's plenty of, I've got plenty of time up here, this is great. Support cases, trouble, you get the point, right? Yeah, shall I click next? All right, great, okay, right. So why did this happen? Well, it happened because the software industry is changing so fast. I mean, it was changing super fast at the time when this was all going on. It was a brilliant time to be in the industry. stuff was changing so fast that there are always new things to pick up and new things to learn. But the challenge was that from a developer standpoint, or even from a user of the software standpoint, the features were more interesting than security at that stage of the game. I want new feature X. Oh, let's just turn it on then. Or let's just develop it. And what you found that even from the software development side was that developing features was absolutely primary to get out the door, and developing features securely, which is a kind of subtle difference, was not the primary goal. It was really about developing features in a fast-moving industry, whole lot of competition. There was also this thing that hacking was kind of cool at the time as well. I mean, War Games, what an awesome movie that was, right? Check that out, that was a great movie. I mean, who could not imagine themselves hooking up an acoustic coupler, right, and dialing in and starting global thermonuclear war? I mean, that was amazing. I wanted to do that with my home PC when I saw that movie. All I was missing, I figured, was the acoustic coupler, because I couldn't get hold of one of those. Apart from that, I was totally on board, but it was kind of cool. The whole hacking thing was kind of cool, and in fact, it still is. You go to a lot of these sessions that are around here, around TechEd as well, and there are plenty of sessions on, you know, hacking and social engineering and all of this stuff, and it's interesting to people. They find it very interesting. Some people find, you know, they'll claim they're going there to protect, but they find it cool, and so do I. It's kind of interesting sometimes. There was also something else going on called the proliferation of the DMZ, or the perimeter network, or if you're English like me, the DMZ, because I can't say the word Z and get away with it very well, right? I don't let my children use that word in the house anymore, or that letter. But the proliferation of that perimeter network was going on as well. So the security guy was establishing layers, because, you know, the more layers somebody has to get through, obviously the better it is. And I saw, you know, security guys in consulting services in Microsoft coming up with, you know, tiers and layers and putting firewalls between Exchange servers and domain controllers and users. They loved that stuff because it allows them to create rules. So that was another thing that was going on as well, which, of course, was driven by the proliferation of the security guy. The IT security guy, tons of them. Right, they were the ones building all the walls. They were the ones putting up all the rules that we all had to comply with. And more often than not, they were making up rules on the fly. And this is a true story as well, which is that I was doing a customer engagement again with another security-minded customer. Get to work with a few of those. And not in the US. They don't like foreigners working on their stuff. I don't know why in the US, but in other places. The security guy asked what we were trying to do, and this was back when we were trying to do ActiveSync and provide a bunch of people in the field with mobile devices, syncing back to Exchange with ActiveSync. And of course, they didn't allow that. This was a new project to put this in. And so the security guy said to me, he said, what is it you're trying to do? So I told him what we were trying to do. And then I swear, I literally saw him turn around and write down something. Now it's in the policy, you're not allowed to do that, you see. That's the problem. And I learned a valuable lesson that day, which is that when the security guy says to you, what is it you're trying to do? Your response should be, well, what am I allowed to do? Tell me what I'm allowed to do. And had he said, well, you're allowed to make, you know, authenticated HTTP connections coming from the outside, as long as they terminate in the DMZ before they go on to something in the internal network, I would have said, all right, that's exactly what I'm going to do. But he didn't. I didn't. My fault. Right, I learned a lesson that day for sure. Crafty buggers, the IT security folks. Okay, so another thing that we told you, Exchange is the we there, and you know Microsoft as well, that ISA at the time, who remembers ISA server lovingly? I do, great product. And then TMG came out, 64-bit and new lipstick. Basically, that was really what it was at that stage. We would tell you that ISA and Exchange were better together. And at the time, they actually were. They were. And we'll come to that why in a second. So they really were better together. So it was obvious. I remember going to different tech eds and listening to people talk about how ISA and Exchange were better together, how to configure them, how to set it all up, and all of that stuff. Why was that a good idea at the time? Well, because at the time, the software was pretty crap. Let's be honest. It's true, isn't it, right? What were we using? You know, we had Windows 2000. Now, that was an awesome product at the time. Is it somebody, you know, well, that got an absolute zero response, right? That was an awesome product at the time. And Exchange 2000, who doesn't remember that as the best product we ever released, huh? Come on. Exchange 2000. Yeah, okay, right. So Exchange 2000, super easy to configure and set up as an open relay, which was a nice handy benefit at the same time. So here's the thing, right? Are the threats that we face today the same as the threats we faced when we were telling you that ISA and Exchange were better together? Is the software that you're using the same as we told you when ISA and Exchange and all of that stuff were, you know, better together? They're not. That much is obvious. I did have a picture of an acoustic coupler in here as well, but, you know, didn't have copyright for the picture. I couldn't put it in there. But you get the idea, right? Old communication style. And the bad guys, are the bad guys doing the same as they did all those years ago? Okay, rhetorical question. The answer is no, they're really not. But why do we continue protecting ourselves in the same way that we did 10 years ago when the risks were quite different? Things have changed. So let's have a look now about how things have moved along. So what are the threats today? Now, here's a really interesting set of bullets I've stolen and credited from a gentleman who wrote something called The Basic Laws of Hackonomics. And this is kind of an interesting set of bullets, which I'm just gonna run through with you here. So we've got that most attackers aren't evil or insane, they just want something. The Hollywood version of hacking, I do love it, don't you, when you see this kind of stuff? Like, he's attacking the firewalls, and you've got all these like little red things coming in, and oh, he's through the first firewall, all that. What a bunch of old nonsense, right? We know that. That's okay. But most of these attackers are not insane. They just want something. So we don't really have the budget to protect against people that are truly evil and just want to do it for the sake of doing it. But we can protect against people that are trying to look for weaker targets. Interesting first rule. Okay, so a rule of hackonomics or a law of hackonomics. Security isn't about security. It's about mitigating risk at some cost. You are not going to be able to secure yourself against every risk. That much is obvious. Anyone who denies that, it's unreasonable to expect that you can protect against yourself cost-effectively against every risk that you might face. But we do tend to focus on risks that are familiar or recent, which is what we've been talking about, right? We tend to focus on what we've always done before because that's the way we've always done it. And so we should carry on doing that. That's kind of human nature, perhaps, right? Not just necessarily IT security. Most costly breaches come from simple failures, not from attacker ingenuity. However, the bad guys, if properly motivated, can be extremely creative. That's true. I find some of the most creative people is kind of interesting. I'm quite, you know, I tend to think quite creative solutions in exchange. And that's one of the things I love about my job sometimes, which is, customer gives you a problem to solve, and you have to come up with a creative way to configure the software that you've been given to solve the particular problem. People, you know, it's not true that IT people have no creativity whatsoever. I hope you would agree. Some do. It's pretty obvious. You can see some of them walking around this conference. That's terrible. Right, but IT, you know, people can be quite creative, particularly if properly motivated. There's the key. How, you know, if bad guys are motivated, it's a hard job to protect against them. In the absence of security education or experience, people naturally make poor security decisions with technology. Exactly, right? I don't really understand what I'm protecting against. I don't really understand how people are going to try and attack me. I'm just going to make a security decision. Typically, you know, the CTO or somebody might make a decision. There's a whole bunch of strange decisions that get made because people don't really understand the problem. These aren't necessarily easy problems to really grasp, but people typically make bad decisions because they don't really understand what the decision is that they're really making. Systems need to be easy to use securely and difficult to use insecurely. There's a good one. Think about that. A well-designed system should be secure in the way that you normally go about using it. So security should be built in as part of the architecture of the application that you're building. Just so you know this, so I've developed features inside Exchange. I've been PM for a few different features in Exchange. And Exchange, and in fact the whole company, Microsoft, have gone through a long period of evolution in this whole space. And I had to go through a security audit and assessment of the features that I was writing, a full security assessment, even though the stuff that I was involved in was really not something that anyone could attack or, you know, or exploit in some way. But it still didn't mean that I didn't have to go through this security delivery lifecycle process. So every single piece of software that goes, that, you know, gets created now goes through this process. And the process is there to make sure that we're not unexpectedly or accidentally creating problems for ourselves. The software should be secure the way you normally operate. It should be difficult to use the software in an insecure manner. Attackers usually don't get in by cracking some impenetrable security control. They look for weak points like trusting employees. Now, that's absolutely true. Anyway, okay? Was anyone's been to any of the sessions around social engineering or any of those kind of things over the last couple of days? Terrific, only a couple of you. So that's fine, because we're going to talk about that quite a bit. The weak link in the chain today, arguably, is not the software, it's the people. And I think most people would probably tend to agree with that. Some may disagree, and that's perfectly fine. But it rather depends on the kind of software that you're using as well, doesn't it, in order to clarify that statement. But most attackers these days are looking at the people, not at the software. So, in fact, in thinking about this, you know, evolution of you know, from past to present, what did we do to the software? And that's Microsoft. So back in, you know, 2000, when all of these kind of challenges and things were going on, Microsoft started something called the whole Trustworthy Computing Initiative. And you've probably seen that. There are even sessions with TWC in the title. So here's what happened, right? So, and there's actually a good website on this. So back in the day, there was a storm. This is a brilliant website. I love this. And I'm slightly rude the way I approach this website. So something called the Perfect Storm. That's apparently what it was. It was around the year 2000. And then what happened, they did a bit of a ramp up. And so you can actually look as you go at the Trustworthy Computing site, and like you see the life cycle of the Trustworthy Computing Initiative. And then what happens, they apparently went to a new bar for some reason. I'm not quite sure why. Maybe it was a new bar in Redmond they all decided was going to be absolutely the place to invent this stuff. They may not have meant that necessarily, but they set a new bar. I prefer to think that they went to a new bar, but that was just me. And then finally, we reached a point, we're claiming here around 2008, where we've got, you know, we've made a significant evolution in software development. So that whole Trustworthy Computing Initiative is the piece of the software piece that Microsoft has gone through over a period of a number of years in order to try and address some of these security and security concerns. So what did all of that do for us? And when I think about us, I'm thinking about Exchange specifically. Well, that whole piece of work really made IIS better. Because a lot of that work was Windows. It was an operating system thing. Well, IIS is part of the operating system, is it not? And IIS is something that Exchange uses exclusively and heavily, and, you know, Exchange loves IIS. So what that meant was the host machine itself got stronger. The data layer got stronger, the perimeter got stronger, which then leads me to think, well, then, you know, you've heard this phrase before, defense in depth, right? The security guys, they do love to build multiple levels of firewalls because they think that defense in depth is important. Well, it is, and if you apply it in the right direction. And so here's how security works, right? Defense in depth is really key. So let's take this as a scenario. Let's say you are protecting a bank. You have a bank, you are protecting a bank. The first thing you should do is put a dirty great fence around it. So that's what we're going to do here, okay? You can put a big fence around the outside of it, but that's just one layer, and the security guy is never going to buy that. So then what you should do is put some sharks in it, actually. You could dig it out, fill it up with water, and you could put sharks in there. That would be a good idea of doing that. And then what you can do, I had some fun with clip art when I was putting this slide deck together. And then you probably should put another layer around that as well, because, you know, if somebody gets past the sharks, right, distracts them, they're totally into the bank. And then you could put a couple of lions around the outside. That would work too. This is actually meant to be amusing, as opposed to you're not meant to be thinking, the guy's crazy, right? You could put a couple of lions, because you should have a different kind of security mechanism, right? Because you don't want the guy who knows how to deal with the sharks, he'll be totally eaten by the lions before he even gets to the sharks. Or you could put a big black widow spider hanging out there outside the bank. That works too. And then if you search Office Clip Art for the word dangerous, this is absolutely true. If you search Office Clip Art for the word dangerous, you get a guy driving a car talking on his cell phone. Now, we all know that is dangerous, right? But the reason it's particularly dangerous for this guy is, look at the size of his phone. Swear to God, dangerous. There you go, office clip art for you. Right, okay. Defense in depth is key. You put different mechanisms in place around the thing that you're trying to protect. You don't just keep putting the same thing over and over again. So that really doesn't do any good at all. There we go. So what happened to the bad guys? Because we changed the software. What happened to the bad guys? The bad guys came to this really interesting realization, which was that people were far more interesting to attack and hack. And people we are generally, you know, tend to be trusting in nature. And we're actually a far softer target these days than the software. Or, put it another way, certainly easier. We're certainly a softer target, that is true. And we're also a target that, you can attack on multiple fronts, right? You know, in any organization, there might be one perimeter firewall, but thousands of employees. You have a much greater chance of finding one successfully who can help you rather than attacking just the one single device or firewall. Which brings me to this thing called social networks, right, and social engineering. Wow. Now, I personally don't have a Facebook account because I don't have any friends. That's the primary reason. There's no point in joining Facebook for that. And I don't have LinkedIn. I don't do Twitter. I don't actually do any of those things. And I would like to say that, you know, that it's because I don't trust this stuff, or maybe it's just because I'm antisocial. I'm not sure. But I never liked the idea of this social networking stuff. I never liked the idea that, and I kept telling my wife about this, when a friend of hers, whose father is quite well known, and they have a lot of money, frankly, right? And so her friend puts on Facebook, yeah, I'm going on holiday for 2 weeks. Come around and burgle my house. It's basically the subtext that you put in there, right? I'm away, having a great time on the beach. Come and burgle my house. It's a really good idea. I never kind of liked that idea. Now, what's been interesting about it is that this social networking thing has actually created a whole new attack vector for bad guys. The bad guys now, and there was a demo of this yesterday afternoon in one of the sessions. There was an example, which is a very straightforward example, which essentially means you can find out stuff about people from the internet. I'm not sure that was, news probably. Certainly wasn't news to me that you can find out stuff about people from the internet, particularly in the US, where as soon as you buy a house or anything like that, practically every detail, including your, personal inside leg measurement, right, is available in public information on the internet in the US. It's kind of interesting. But social networking brings that to a whole new level. You can find out more than just, you know, where somebody lives. You can find out their date of birth. You can find out all kinds of things. You can find out, you know, and here's a classic one as well, mother's maiden name. Now, in some countries, that's kind of, you know, I used to give security details to the bank when I'd call them as date of birth and my mother's maiden name. Not terribly hard to find that stuff out. If you follow somebody on Facebook, you go look at them and can dig around a little bit. That kind of information is probably fairly freely available. Now, so the fact that social networks are around actually has increased the threat in an IT security perspective dramatically. And so the more a company like us, and we do it because customers demand it, is we hook in Facebook and LinkedIn and all those other things into corporate environments by making Outlook, giving Outlook the ability to go off and talk to all these different things, right? What are we adding as a risk, all right, to the whole environment? And what's worse as well is that, you know, now you have this approach where social networking and all kinds of different companies are trying to get you to use their authentication provider to authenticate you to multiple services. Log in once to, you know, your Google account and have access to all these different things. Log in once to Facebook or the Microsoft account and have access to all these different things. Well, what if all these different things that you have, so you get into one, you get into them all. Okay? It's a pretty obvious statement, right? But what if people are starting to use the same sets of credentials? Because honestly, people are not that good with passwords, are they? Let's be honest, right? I have trouble every time my password comes to expire. I'm always like, oh, crap. What do I make it now? I've run out of password 1234. I guess I should probably just add a 5 on the end of it and carry on, right? Now, our complexity stuff doesn't actually allow me to do that, which actually makes it really more frustrating, because then I have to come up with passwords I can barely remember. And when I had bio, I had a laptop with, you know, fingerprint reading, I'd set that up, and then I forgot my password. I couldn't remember my password anymore. Absolutely true. So, you know, but those companies that don't sort of set that stuff up, you know, don't have complexity, have simple passwords. Users tend to use the same password over and over again. There was a statistic thrown out yesterday in one of the sessions that 47% of people use the same password for everything. Would anyone consider themselves in that bucket? I do. I probably do. And it's not password 1234 or 5, by the way. I added a 6 on the end, so it's all nice and safe now. Okay, so the bad guys now are actually more interested in exploiting the human being than they are interested in exploiting the software, because it's considerably easier. We make it easier for them. Sorry, social networking makes it easier for them. Users are stupid, and they make it easier for them as well by using the same password for everything. So there's the problem. So this is a story. Here's another true story. I try to use true stories rather than made-up stories. about something, you know, barrier security, putting up layers. And this actually happened from a conversation I had at TechEd either last year or the year before, perhaps. There was a guy who came up to talk to me, and he was sad. He was a bit annoyed. He was the IT guy for a consulting company, an IT consulting company. And why was he sad? Well, he was sad because, well, he couldn't get to play golf. And he really liked to play golf. I had a lot of fun with clip art, as you can tell, during this whole presentation, right? He liked to play golf. He thought he was still young enough to skateboard. He probably wasn't, actually, but I didn't have the heart to tell him at the time. And like most men of our age, he had to do a lot of kind of home improvement stuff. I've definitely been doing a bit of that, right? Well, he felt like a puppet at work. That was why he was sad. And he felt like a puppet because he was having a battle with his employees. All of the consultants that worked in this guy's organization were giving him an absolute nightmare. They were ganging up on him, that's what he thought. And they wanted to run off with his data. That was basically the reason for it. And he decided they were probably having a good old party behind his back and laughing at him because everything he tried to do, they worked around. Well, they were IT consultants. It was kind of their job to be fairly savvy with the technology. And everything he kept putting in place, they kept working around. And he kept escalating, and they kept figuring out ways around it because they were a pretty smart bunch of IT consultants who were doing this for all kinds of customers. Now, he and I had a bit of a chat. It was very dark, obviously, in the room at the time, as you can see from the picture. And my suggestion to him was, well, why don't you clean up? Why don't you clean up all the policy? Why don't we try a different approach? Why don't you get rid of all of the unnecessary layers and complexity? And by that, I mean, oh, yeah, they need a multi-factor, two-factor auth thing with the cell phone text message and the little key fob thing. Who's got the key fobs? Love those. Really, really user-friendly, aren't they? Aren't they super? Users love those. I always do. All of that kind of jazz, right? He had them doing all of that. Just so what? Just so they could do their jobs. I mean, the people that were in the company, their intention was to do their job, just to get on with work, to get to email, to get to applications that would allow them to work for the company's customers. But instead of that, they were wasting their time trying to work their ways around these ridiculous security measures that this company had put in place that were just making it harder to get access. Here's a good one for you, right? The security guy, IT security guy's job is not to secure the data. It's to provide secure access to the data. Huge difference. Huge difference. He should provide secure access to the data. A company that, let me finish the story about this guy before I carry on ranting. I could talk about this stuff for hours, and I probably will. All right, so we had a chat about clearing up all of his controls. You know, what can we do to simplify? Well, the first thing was he got a gun. No, that's not true. That's a whole different fella. He created an acceptable use policy, which meant he would fire, get it now, anybody that breached the acceptable use policy. How many of your companies have an acceptable use policy? Show of hands. All right. How many of your companies would actually fire someone if they breached the acceptable use policy? That's a much smaller number than those of you that have acceptable use policies, right? Okay. And I'm not saying that, you know, somebody who goes and accidentally stumbles across, you know, a random picture on the internet therefore as breach and acceptable use policy should be fired. I'm just saying that most acceptable use policies don't really have a lot of teeth in them, and most people tend to ignore them. All right? That's typically the case with users. And so he sat back at that stage. So we did a bit of a change, acceptable use policy put in place. He sat back and watched what happened. And what do you think actually happened? Do you think they ran off with all his stuff? Actually, they just kind of got on working, really. They now had access to the data that was allowing them to actually do their jobs. And that was really their goal. They weren't really trying to just, I mean, they were, I'm sure some of them were just doing it to piss him off, right? Just for fun, because they could. But most of them really just wanted to do their jobs. And so it made a big difference to him and that company. In fact, he found internal peace. He really did. And internal peace, as we know, leads typically to love, right? Which then, as we know, leads back to home improvement and everything, right? Which is the end of that story, right? But it's absolutely true that the simplification of the IT security that he had in place, actually, really, the result of it was the employees just got on with their jobs. He took out the barriers that were causing them so much frustration that they felt the need to work around the barriers. If you keep people within control, if you keep them within arm's length, what is it they say? You know, keep your friends close and your enemies closer, right? If you keep everybody within the frame so you can see everybody, it's a much easier job to watch what they're doing. As soon as they start going off at a tangent, you can't really see what people are up to, which actually makes it a lot more risky. All right, so here's some evidential proof if you needed it. So Microsoft IT took away pre-auth, coming back to Exchange for a second, back in the room, right? I'd almost forgotten about that. We took away pre-auth in front of Exchange years ago. And in fact, OWA, our own deployment of Outlook Web App, Access, or whatever name we're giving it this particular release, we never had pre-authentication in front of it, ever. Despite what we told you, our customers, our fabulous customers, right? We never did any of that stuff ourselves. There was a reason for OWA. The reason for OWA was we decided to brand our OWA homepage back in the days of, you know, wherever. And you couldn't do that on ISA at the time, so we decided to do that on Exchange. Was that supported at the time? Not so much, really. But when you have all the developers working in the same campus and everything, it makes it a heck of a lot easier to get support, right? Okay, that's true. We also had the problem at the time where ISA server wouldn't allow you on the same listener to do forms-based auth and basic auth on the same listener. Remember those days? Okay, ISA 2004, I think it was, that fixed that one. But what that meant was you couldn't have mail.microsoft.com for both pop up a form for an OWA user and also provide a basic auth prompt for an Outlook Anywhere or an ActiveSync user. So what we did was we did pre-auth at the time for ActiveSync and Outlook Anywhere, and we let OWA go all the way through to Exchange. Surprising, perhaps, but that's the way we did it. Exchange Online doesn't have pre-auth. There's no pre-authenticating firewall in front of it, put it like that. All right? There is an authentication service which you have to hit in order so we can find the right endpoint for you to get to, but that's not quite the same. There's no pre-authenticating firewall in front of that authentication service. I mean, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is you aren't going to find a pre-authenticating firewall that would scale probably to that kind of scale. But we also made a decision that we don't need one. We don't need one. We haven't had one in front of Exchange on-prem for years. We're certainly not going to add that into Exchange Online. We don't need to do that. Why don't we do that? Because we have confidence in the software's ability to withstand attacks without any pre-authenticating firewall in front of it. We've engineered the software so that you can put it straight on the internet. You don't need to pre-authenticate connections to it because Windows and Exchange together are now mature enough and secure enough to be able to protect you directly put on the internet. How many of you believe that statement? Some of you, all right. Let's see how many of you believe that at the end of this today, all right? So, random bullet point here, but I had to find somewhere to throw this one in, which is, you know, quite often when we talk about hybrid, you know, you kind of have that conversation. I have a conversation quite often with security people, and hybrid comes up. You know, and they say, well, now we're going to go hybrid, and we have a pre-authenticating firewall, and now we're going to go hybrid, you have to allow some path through unauthenticated. That's a complete disaster. What about IP spoofing? Well, that risk hasn't changed. You have to kind of bring them back sometimes too. What are the risks you're protecting against? And how has introducing something like hybrid changed it? And quite often you'll find it hasn't. What I've often found in conversations with security guys is you really ask them, what's the practical implementation of this risk that you're talking about? Because often they'll throw out a whole bunch of phrases which nobody from the exchange world really understands. And honestly, some of the security folks I've heard as well don't really understand, but they like to baffle and bamboozle, right? So push back on some of these things. Anyway, so what's key to this really is management and monitoring. So the conclusion, if you think about, we've now engineered our software to be more secure, which we absolutely have, right? Exchange hanging straight on the internet, we believe now to be secure enough that you can just do that, no pre-authenticating firewall. I repeat, no pre-authenticating firewall. So why are we still thinking about it like it's 1999? Prince. That was great. It came to mind as I was writing that slide there, right? We've got to stop. You know, pre-authentication might help, and I've got here one example, denial of service, essentially, right? You could potentially, you know, stopping traffic in front of exchange could help with the denial of service, but also intrusion detection systems can also help with that too, and you can do that at the router layer rather than, you know, or the network layer rather than at the host layer. You can do that. But here's the fact, though. A properly managed exchange, managed and monitored exchange deployment doesn't require pre-auth, but the key words here are properly managed and monitored. You shouldn't just, you know, with Exchange, just set up Exchange and on Windows and publish it on the internet, because Greg said you should do that. I'm telling you should do that, but I'm telling you that you also have to manage and monitor the thing as well. So just because you've put that pre-authenticating firewall in front of it, as you previously would have done, it wouldn't mean that you would immediately stop watching the firewall, would it? It's kind of like an insurance policy, this firewall thing, for most companies. It's like, well, I've bought a firewall, I'm going to put a firewall in, now I'm safe, and I'm done. And any company that does that, they're nuts, because the firewall is, you know, that point that they should still be watching the firewall, right? If you're still going to watch the firewall, then why don't you just watch Exchange instead? Because you're going to have to watch Exchange anyway, but you're having to watch more things if you actually put a pre-authenticating firewall in front of it. Why don't you just get rid of one and just watch Exchange? That would probably be a better way of going about it. So here's a couple of other bits as well. So you've got to watch it. It's more an insurance policy. It's not, you know, Kevlar. It's not a bulletproof vest. It's a firewall. That's for sure. So there's a couple of things that come around here. So account lockout policies. So one reason for putting them in as well, you know, we have our firewall doing a soft account lockout policy, right? I know that's come up in conversation over the last few days. How many of you have account lockout policies in place at your companies? Come on, right? We haven't actually. Now, it's interesting. I've previously said we haven't recommended account lockout policies for years. And then I discovered recently, apparently we do in Windows Server, in one of their security hardening guides or something, recommends you should have account lockout policies set to, you know, potentially 5 or 50. An account lockout policy is an invitation to a denial of service. Completely. An account lockout, denial of service. So in this day and age of connected machines and internet access that we're all providing, you should set, and certainly if you're an Exchange Online, UPN to equal SMTP address, right? Now I know your UPN. And in fact, the Windows guys who tell you, or you know, the security guys on that side who tell you that, you know, 5 account lockout, you know, the policy should be set to 5 failed attempts. They also tell you, I think, that you shouldn't set the UPN the same as your SMTP address. Well, that's absolutely genius, unless you happen to have an email account, you know, want to access your mailbox. Because how many users really like to remember their UPN? Yeah, well, you know, you don't use your SMTP address there. No. You use this really funky long UPN or /domain/username, which isn't going to work either. It doesn't really work from a user perspective. You should set UPN equal to SMTP address. Otherwise, you get a whole bunch of help desk calls because users can't remember what the UPN is. Now, if you do that, you've immediately handed to the bad guy the UPN. And you've immediately then given them the opportunity to lock the person's account out if you have an account lockout policy. And so just by knowing your email address, I can lock your account out if I can get access to OWA on your company, whether it's pre-auth or not. Now, some pre-authenticating firewalls will say, well, we have a soft account lockout policy, right? We can lock out the account for attempts coming from the outside, we could do a soft lockout. So I only allow 3 attempts from the outside, but I'll allow 5 inside. Well, great, okay? But it doesn't stop internal accounts locking you out. It also doesn't necessarily work when you have multiple endpoints, multiple firewalls, which each have their own soft account lockout policy. So if I've got 3 of those with a soft lockout policy set to 3 on each, and I make a multitude of connections, I could get 3 for that one, 3 from that one, and 3 from that one. I've just locked your account out. Inside it was 5. Account lockout policies. The better approach to that is either set the number very high, so you prevent automated denial of service attempts at account lockout, or better yet, don't have them at all, and enforce strong passwords and passphrases. In fact, here, let me ask another poll question. It's kind of interesting. How many of you that have account lockout policies also have strong password passphrase? So you've set a policy up that is strong password and passphrase, and you have account lockout policies too. Well, you like the belt and the suspenders too. You really don't want your pants falling down at any point, do you? Right? But you see the point. I mean, the point of having tough passwords and passphrases is so that you don't have account lockout policies. That was the point. And then what you do is you use intrusion detection software or something else to monitor those password cracking attempts, and then you do act on those rather than inconvenience everyone by locking out their account. Because you've set up a strong password or passphrase which nobody can remember, so they keep locking their own account out. I bet a whole bunch of those people that put their hands up also have a bunch of users that keep calling because they've forgotten their passwords. Anyway, okay. Dear, oh dear, that's one of my favorite rants. Sorry about that. Okay, so here's a mitigation checklist. Not a migration checklist, that's a whole different checklist. This is a mitigation checklist, right? Okay, so in order to be properly managed and secure, properly managed and monitored, do you run on the latest OS with the latest patches? Probably-ish, maybe. Do you have the latest Exchange versions? And I'm not trying to just upsell you to the newest version of Exchange. The newest version of Exchange will always contain our biggest collection of security fixes and product fixes, which make the product more secure, right? Pretty straightforward. Do you know when updates come out? Or do you just kind of get to them, you discover, oh, look, there's a new cumulative update for Exchange and a new security update for Windows have come out. Do you know they're coming out? Or do you just stumble across them? And then when you stumble across them, do you then go through weeks and weeks of integration testing and testing before you actually deploy them into production? All of that time, while you're doing all that testing, you're obviously exposing yourself to potentially any risks that were closed down in that particular update. Quite often, testing takes way longer than it really should. I think probably most of us would probably agree with that. But we do it anyway, because we should. We should kind of speed that process up, figure out a way of understanding when the updates come out and how to speed that process up. Do you know what's going on at the network edge? Do they put the firewall there and just forget it, or do they really know what's going on? And then here's an interesting one. Have they mitigated against the risks inside? Because just concentrating on the network edge isn't necessarily going to solve all the problems, is it? You're looking at it from purely one perspective. Most of the account lockouts and most of the attacks potentially these days come from inside an organization. Social engineering, whether by accident or by design, those attacks are coming from inside. And so I always throw it back on the security guys when we get drilled down and heads bogged down in firewalls and multiple layers of tiers of DMZ, and they bring me to tears. Most of these plans are DMZs, I tell you. You ask them, what are you doing on the inside to mitigate against these risks? Well, nothing. Our network's secure inside. Really? Right? It never really is. But they'd rather focus on the network edge. We're done then, right? Everyone happy? Just put excellent, right? I had a feeling you weren't convinced yet, but thank you for that. I appreciate the token gesture there. Either you are happy I'll be finished, or which is fine. All right, so let's assume for a second that you're not buying that, right? That I'm going to go a little more into some of the background. Okay, don't panic. Okay, so here are some of the reasons why people don't buy that. So, it's policy. Honestly, I've just written the policy, and here's the policy. Right, fell for that one before. Don't fall for that one again. You don't trust anyone. Your data is super secret. Most of the companies I hear that from, they make pencils, or cupcakes, plastic toys. I mean, maybe their data is, I'm sure to them, you know, their cupcake recipe is probably the most important thing they possess. I mean, it is IP after all, it's great. But it's interesting that most of the zealous security guys that I meet come from companies that are not typically what you would think, you know, a big risk from hackers and security breaches. But, you know, they read their book on IT security, and so they're going to do a good job for their pencil-making company. Here's another one, that they don't have any way of getting the traffic. We can't get the traffic from the internet to our servers inside. It just doesn't work. All right, it's another good one. Pre-auth has got to be better than nothing. I love that one. We bought this stuff, and now, by God, we're going to use it. That's the exchange, I bought a SAN, and now I'm going to design Exchange to work with the SAN argument. Okay? There's the, I want to interrogate a device before allowing it in to make sure they've got Angry Birds, the latest version. That's an important one. They require multi-factor auth. I love that one. Multi-factor auth. Quite often when you ask a security guy, he says, yeah, we have to have two-factor auth. And I say, well, what do you mean by that? He says, an RSA secure ID token. So, no, that's not two-factor auth. I ask you, you know, what do you need? Two-factor auth, something you have and something you know, right? The RSA secure ID thing is great, super solution, but it's a solution. It's not the definition of what two-factor auth is. You can address two-factor auth in a multitude of different ways. A certificate on a device and the user's credentials. Something you have, a certificate, something you know, the credentials. That's two-factor auth. So when you get into a two-factor auth discussion, I would always ask the security guy, what's your definition of two-factor auth? And typically, if he comes back with a solution rather than a definition, then you know he's already made his mind up that, yeah, there can be only one. It's the Highlander principle, it's often known as. And that worked with some of you, right? You're kind of on a bit of a hiding to nothing. You have to redefine the definition of what two-factor auth is. And the last one is, of course, that you're scared of the security guy because he's generally a big lad with, he's scary looking. But what are your choices? So here's all the three-letter acronyms. We're finally getting to the three-letter acronym part. So we've got TMG, UAG, ARR, and WAP. They're the Microsoft choices. You could also do load balancer with some pre-auth, and there are other reverse proxies too. Now, I'm talking about Exchange, but I do bear in mind that there are other things that companies typically publish too. There's apparently products called like SharePoint, something like that? I don't know. Lunk? Yeah, I don't know. These other things, and other applications too, apparently. They have stuff that we don't make. So you have to think about those too, but I'm going to think about this from an Exchange perspective because that's, you know, my background. So TMG, oh, I demand, poor old TMG, right? TMG rocked for Exchange. TMG, Threat Management Gateway, just spell out the old three-letter acronyms for us. You could do performance-based auth, you could do basic or NTLM auth, you could do certificate-based auth, you had a whole bunch of choices. You could do plugins and add stuff into it too. And it could talk back to either AD directly, or it could do LDAP. It could talk to AD directly, or AD through LDAP or Radius as well. You could even do soft lockout policies on it. Okay, on the Radius, you could do soft lockout policies. And then TMG actually, late in life, added soft lockout too. But it was the soft lockout where, if you had multiple servers, they didn't communicate with each other about how many soft lockouts they had done for a particular account. So if you hit them all, you could still lock the account out. Not sure I think that was a super idea, but there you go. Now, TMG was great in a way as well, because it could fake Exchange to the end user. It could put up a page that looked very much like our OAuth performance-based auth page. And so you could pop it into an environment. People wouldn't really notice what goes on at the bottom of the screen. You know the bit where it warns you, all the government warnings and stuff? They ignore all of that, right? Most users do. And so they could ignore that, and they would think they're still talking to Exchange. That was great. But the reality was that TMG didn't know anything really more than Exchange than 2000. You know, all this talk about TMG, and I've probably said it myself at some point, right? TMG knows what a good Exchange packet looks like. No, it doesn't. It has no idea what an Exchange packet looks like. It knows what the HTTP filter set up out the defaults from the year 2000 know what an Exchange packet looks like, but quite a lot had changed since then, but TMG didn't really understand that. But you still had protection, you still had, you know, flood mitigation protection, you had a whole bunch of other type of network mitigation and protection features you had too. But anyway, it doesn't matter because TMG, rest in peace. We no longer sell TMG. If you have TMG, you can continue to deploy TMG if you have the licenses for it. I also know there are some vendors who sell hardware solutions with TMG already on them as well. I'm not suggesting you go and buy those. I'm just saying that there are those solutions are still available. TMG for Exchange was great. And what you quite often found in customers was TMG was put in to publish Exchange. And then the real firewall was put in to publish all the other applications. Anyone ever been in that position? I bet they have. Right, okay. So, and that was fine, because the Exchange guys understood TMG. And the security guys think that only a piece of hardware, like a hardware firewall, can possibly be safe and secure. Well, that's complete nonsense, too. We'll talk about why later. Then there was something called Unified Access Gateway, UAG. Now, any of you had fun enough, ever had time to play with UAG? UAG's awesome, isn't it? It had a user interface that I've actually said before. It had a user interface that looked like it was created by a bunch of six-year-olds on a rainy Thursday morning. So we're going to get in trouble for that. But it's dead now. So, really? Right, no, come on. Do you know what? UAG actually was really powerful. Problem was, nobody understood it. Me included. And I wrote a white paper on how to configure it for Exchange, right? Really, really powerful product. Built on top of TMG. So it was like you had TMG under the covers, and then you put UAG's awesome user interface on top of it with some really powerful scripting and clever stuff going on as well. And UAG could do endpoint inspection for browser-based access, right? Quite often it's like, can I use UMG to stop non-domain joined Outlook clients from connecting to my network? Can I use the endpoint inspection? That was a common question. And then you discovered, after you'd battled your way through the configuration of it, that the answer was no. I mean, sure, you could, you know, but you couldn't, right? That was never going to work. But UAG had a ton of power, had a whole ton more power to do endpoint health inspection and everything else. But frankly, it was a bear to configure for Exchange, and some scenarios didn't work. Certificate-based auth and hybrid don't work with UAG. Right now, UAG doesn't work with the new MAPI HTTP protocol that Outlook is using to talk to Outlook 2013 SP1, is using to talk to Exchange 2013 SP1. UAG's deep inspection doesn't like that very much. It built on top of TMG's basic level protection a whole bunch more, so much more that it doesn't actually work now with the current protocol because it doesn't really understand it and it doesn't like it. And quite often you found with UAG as well, was that when Exchange released a service pack or an update, if we change something, particularly in OWA, it's the most simple, because there's so much going on, it's all HTTP browser-based stuff, UAG would stop working. So you had to be careful with that. Anyway, UAG's gone as well. So we announced end of life for UAG as well. So gaping void, what do we do now? So why do we do that? Well, we really made those choices because, as I think I've possibly said already, stuff is changing in this industry, right? And particularly when you look at trends like BYOD and federation, web clients, all these different types of ways of accessing data and the devices that clients are using to access the data is changing dramatically. And so what happened was a generic firewall like that really isn't smart enough. If you're going to insist on having some kind of device in the perimeter network, don't put Exchange in the perimeter network. If you're going to have anything, put something dedicated to that device in the perimeter network. These devices didn't really understand a lot of the new stuff that was going on. Federation's a great example, right? You could configure some of it. You could configure pass-through and a whole bunch of different things. You could publish ADFS proxy. But they weren't really focused on the modern-day scenarios that we have and that we're faced with today. And so those products were legacy in the sense that, you know, they were very much worked on the last 10 years, the things that we've talked about. They're not really forward thinking. So we wanted to make, come up with something that would allow, and here's the phrase, allow people to work securely rather than securing the assets. And I really believe strongly in that one. The security guy's job should be to allow people to access their data securely. But they should be able to access the data, right? Not just securing it. And then give them free rein. They should have secure access to it. That's a better way. And of course, we also wanted to get the code into Windows Server. All right. So that was another strategy. So "Arr," said the pirate. "Who's heard of ARR, Application Request Routing, or routing, because that's how I say it. But I'm in America today, so we'll say routing for you. So ARR is kind of interesting. ARR came about as a direct result of Apache offering up, you know, simple web farm proxying, you know, the ability to essentially publish websites. It was a bit of a kind of garage project, if you like, from people in the Windows Server team, IIS. And basically what it really does is it's a reverse proxy add-in to IIS that allows you to configure a farm of servers behind it, configure some rules at the front end, and then publish this farm of servers behind it. Web farm publishing add-in. Great. It has no idea what Exchange is either. Exchange is just an HTTP-based protocol as far as it's concerned. Payload, right? Now, some people, and we have written blogs on how to configure ARR for Exchange, but that is not necessarily what I'm suggesting that you do. And in fact, probably quite the opposite. The reason we've written the blogs and why we quite often write blogs about stuff is if you're going to go ahead and do it and deploy it, we would rather that we had at least been through and tested it once and satisfied ourselves that it works, and then we'll tell you, well, if you just do it the same as we did it, we'll be happy to support it. Rather than you're going to go ahead and do it regardless, the Exchange team haven't told you anything about how it might or might not work, and then you send yourself down a path from which, you know, only pain will come, right? So we published some articles that said, if you're going to do it like this. So there's no pre-auth. Here's the key thing. There's no pre-auth still. ARR is not a pre-authentication system. And the other thing is there is no ongoing investment in ARR. It's dead. Dead technology. It was a one-off project. It's going to stay that way. There'll be nothing more going on. There's no PowerShell. There's no special monitoring. There's no high availability. But the price is right because it's free. That's the key thing. All right? So ARR, see it. There's blog posts on the ELO blog site, on the product team's blog, and how to configure it. You know, have a go at it. That's great. But ARR is probably not the one. So here's a new one, WAP. Who's heard of WAP? Web Application Proxy. Hopefully a few more of you. And I like to do this when I do it. WAP. Because it reminds me very much of, jump forward. WAP, right, because every time I say it, I feel like a Batman thing coming on, right? So WAP's a server role built into Windows Server 2012 R2. And as I said here, it's kind of a forward-thinking approach. We're taking an approach where it's built for Federation and OAuth, and don't ask me what magic beans are. That's still NDA information, right? So, but it's built for today's modern protocols and clients. It authenticates against ADFS, not against Active Directory directly. ADFS obviously gets to talk to AD. But, you know, this is an ADFS federation type thing, specifically kind of designed to deal with things like BYOD and device enrollment and a whole bunch of other kind of more up-to-date modern ways of dealing with clients and connectivity that we have today. It is the strategic choice currently for Microsoft. So if rather than go and deploy ARR, which is, you know, a dead-end technology from our perspective, WAP is the future perspective. And the price is still right, because if you bought Windows Server 2012 R2, then you get ARR for free. It essentially is the ADFS proxy. It replaces ADFS proxy. Now, there is a slight downside to this, which is that WAP only does pre-auth. If pre-auth is your bag, and I think we've already said, I don't necessarily think pre-auth is certainly not a, shouldn't be a deal killer, but I know for some of you, that will be a longer conversation. You only get pre-auth for OAuth traffic at the moment, which is a shame, right? But the Windows Server team, they have committed to bring pre-auth for Outlook Anywhere and ActiveSync to WAP in a future release. Yay! You see, you're failing miserably on the audible sigh and audible cheer, but I give you it's like still early in the morning, so we'll let you off. Okay, so here's the thing about WAP, though. If you deploy WAP today, you could move, you know, OAuth across to it, perhaps, and do ADFS logon. In fact, this will give you ADFS logon to Exchange 2010 as well, okay, with Kerberos constrained delegation and all of that good stuff going on. So, in fact, you've got some interesting options there. And If you do that for a tactical choice for OWA today, then as the Windows Server team add features and functionality to WAP, then ActiveSync and Outlook Anywhere will come later on, and then it becomes your longer-term strategic choice later on. So there's another option for you as well. Okay, so WAP would be the strategic choice if you were to make a choice and want to pick a Microsoft solution. And here's a little picture about, you know, where WAP would fit into the network. Now, I'm going to the reason that this is a standard slide, which you'll see in some of the sessions. And you can see that, you know, the web application proxy, which is sitting on Windows Server 2012, has the ADFS proxy, you know, element built within it as well. It sits in the perimeter network, talks back to AD inside the network and the back-end server. But let me tell you what I think is wrong with this diagram. This thing. You've got a firewall sitting in front of a load balancer. In case you're not sure which bit I mean, it's this little thing here. Yeah, I was playing around with animation. Right, okay. Why put a firewall in front of the load balancer? The load balancer would be configured, correct me if I'm wrong here, traffic inbound TCP 443, allow it through, right? So if the load balancer, which is a pretty smart network device these days, very smart network device, if the load balancer is only going to allow traffic inbound on TCP 443, why the hell do you need to put a firewall in front of it? Which is going to do what? Have a rule that says allow inbound TCP 443 traffic and forward it to the load balancer. Are you kidding me? Utterly unnecessary, in my opinion. Put the load balancer on the internet. That's what we do. Microsoft, load balancer on the internet. So rather than dwell too much on WAP and in the benefits of time here, so there's a session going on this afternoon. Shai Kari from the web application proxy team is doing a session this afternoon. We had a session at the WAP and ARR, which we did at MEC, which was about a month or so ago. Well, it seems longer ago now. And this is available on Channel 9. My friends Georg and Roop did a session on that. They walk through both ARR configuration and WAP configuration, so you can watch that one too. Okay, so let's go back to the load balancer piece for a second, right? So the load balancer is also a network device, which is doing network filtering, but some of these load balancers also offer you this pre-auth ability as well. And the reason they've done that is for the TMG and UAG exiting the market. So let's just do that. And so they provide pre-auth against AD. Some of them will then do Kerberos constrained delegation back to Exchange. But I'll throw this one out there. That I don't really see a whole heap of value in this too. This is the whole same. They don't understand an Exchange packet any better than I think my mother really does. And so why would you, the pre-auth piece, we've already talked about ad nauseum, right? I'm not going to go back on that one again. But I would argue that the network device allowing only TCP 443 in, talking to an Exchange server, running on the latest bits, the latest security bits on a well-managed and monitored machine, you don't need to do the pre-auth. That would be the assertion that I would make to you. All right, what else? Well, that is just use the load balancer on its own. And this is actually really the key, if it was to do one thing, the one recommendation, really consider just putting the load balancer, one leg on the internet, one leg inside, which I realize will bring terror and perhaps amusement to some of you in the room. But this is exactly what we do at Microsoft now, and this is exactly what a whole bunch of other customers that I know get to do as well. They put a load balancer straight on the internet, allowing in only the traffic that they want, and they forward it to their Exchange servers or whatever application servers they've got, and they watch what's going on. And they have software that does intrusion detection, so they understand, and the network device, the load balancer, also does that protection as well. So if you've got all of that in place, you really don't need to put some advanced firewall that can understand your traffic in front of the load balancer. You've already got a load balancer for Exchange anyway. It's a fine device. And probably if you ask the load balancer vendor, is it secure enough to be put straight on the internet, what do you think the response will be? Hell yeah. Of course it should be. Otherwise, that's probably not the best device, right? Absolutely, it should be. Okay, so what should you do? Well, the first thing, obviously, you should do is probably panic. I find it's usually a good idea when you have these kind of decisions to make. But Just because TMG and UAG are EOL does not mean you are SOL. If you don't know what those three acronyms are, I'm afraid you'll have to look those up. All right, I'm not the last one particularly. TMG and UAG are dead. Now, I used to make this, comment that just because TMG is dead doesn't mean you should rip it out and replace it. And I used to have this analogy where I said, well, I have a, I moved to the US and I bought, obviously, a big car. That's what you do when you move to the US as a European. So I bought an old Ford Expedition, monstrous thing, terrible fuel economy. I mean, literally, every time I started it up, trees spontaneously combusted around me. Horrendous thing. Now, it was quite an old car at the time, because my wife got the brand new car. Obviously, I got the crappy old car. And so I'd say, well, Ford don't make that car anymore. It's a Ford, for those of you that don't know what an Expedition is, right? Ford don't make that car anymore. They make a newer version of that car, but they don't make that car. Now, just because they don't make that car, does it mean I have to sell it and get rid of it? Just because Microsoft stopped selling TMG, does it mean I should rip it out and find something to replace it with? No, because that car worked great. It was super reliable, until it stopped being super reliable, but that was at some point after, some years after I'd had it, right? And so just because your car is no longer made, you don't immediately sell it and buy another one. And the same is true with the software. The thing continues to work just great. For most customers, TMG works just great. Leave it right there, working just great. Keep watching it. And then think about what you want to do after that fact. Don't just throw it away just because it went end of life. As it happens, I got rid of my car and bought a big-ass truck now. But, the analogy, I think, still holds true. So you've got to evaluate what you're trying to mitigate against anyway. That's really the key point. So here's your call to action as we wrap up with just a couple of minutes to spare. So if you really are as good as you think you are, and you manage it, and you should be, right? If you're at an event like this, you want to learn more, you want to improve skills, that's the point of Tech Ed. Don't complicate it with stuff you don't need. Think logically about what it is you're doing, what you're protecting, and make decisions based on that rather than just, this is just the way we've always done it. But if you're not good enough, then fine. Leave your pre-authenticating firewalls, call it an insurance policy, probably. But one day, honestly, that thing's going to stop working, and then you're going to have to figure out what to do. But really, the summary would be for this, would be I want you to really have a think about, what it is that you, what are the risks you're trying to mitigate against? Do the measures you have in place really still guard against the risks we see today? Or are you still just doing things the way we've always done it before? And so on that note, there's obviously a couple of extra slides. There's definitely these two sessions you might want to go and see. The session yesterday, John Craddock, has already happened, but you've got the web application proxy session to do later today. You've also got the Garage series down in the Office Expo. People are leaving now, but I'm gonna finish it at that stage. Say, I hope you found it useful, informative, and maybe a little entertaining. Don't forget to fill out the evals. Hope it was useful information, and thank you very much.